welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's narration is titled The Victories of Revisionism, and it was written by Professor Robert Fourasson to President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And it begins with an abstract saying, at the Nuremberg trial, 1945 to 1946, a tribunal of the victors accused a defeated Germany, notably one of having ordered and planned the physical extermination of the Jews of Europe. Two, of having to that end designed and used certain weapons of mass destruction, in particular those that it called gas chambers. Three, of having, essentially with those weapons, but also through other means, caused the death of 6 million Jews. In support of that threefold accusation, regularly taken up over the past 60 years by all the main communications media in the West, no proof capable of standing up to examination has been produced. Professor Robert Fourasson concluded in 1980, the alleged Hitlerite gas chambers and the alleged genocide of the Jews form one and the same historical lie, which has permitted a gigantic political and financial swindle whose main beneficiaries are the State of Israel and international Zionism, and whose main victims are the German people, but not their leaders, and the Palestinian people in their entirety. In 2006, he maintains that conclusion in full. In nearly 60 years, the revisionists, beginning with the Frenchmen Maurice Bardèche and Paul Racinière, have accumulated, from the historical and scientific point of view, an impressive series of victories over their opponents. 20 examples of such victories, running from 1951 until today, are given here. Revisionism is not an ideology, but a method, inspired by the search for exactitude in matters of history. Circumstances have seen to it that revisionism is also the great intellectual adventure of the present time. Born in 1929 of a French father and a Scottish mother, Robert Fourasson taught classical letters, French, Latin and Greek, before specialising first in the analysis of modern and contemporary French literary texts, and finally in the appraisal of texts and documents, literature, history and media. He was professor at the Sorbonne and the University of Lyon. Because of his historical revisionist stance, he was effectively forbidden from teaching. He has incurred many convictions in the law courts and has suffered 10 physical assaults. In France, access to the press, radio and television is barred to him, as it is to all revisionists. Among his works are Écrits Revisionnistes, 1974 to 1998, in 4 volumes. The present summary has as its title, The Victories of Revisionism and Not History of Revisionism or Arguments of the Revisionist Case. It deals only with victories that our opponents have had to concede to us, either explicitly or implicitly. Therefore, one must not expect to find here a systematic mention of revisionist authors, works, or arguments. If still I had to recommend a short sample of revisionist readings, I should suggest the prime work of reference that is The Hoax of the 20th Century, The Case Against the Presumed Extermination of European Jewry, published by Arthur Robert Butts in 1976. The book is masterful. In the 30 years of its existence, no one has attempted the least refutation, so solidly is it built. I especially recommend the 2003 edition, enhanced by 5 remarkable supplements. It would also be appropriate to read Fred Leuchter's famous study, an engineering report on the alleged execution gas chambers at Auschwitz, Birkenau and Majdanek, Poland. Particularly in the gilt cover edition issued by Samizdat Publishers in Toronto in 1988, containing on page 42 the text of a letter of capital importance dated May 14th, 1988, on the utter absence of openings in the roofs of the alleged gas chambers of Crematoria 2 and 3 at Auschwitz-Birkenau. Fred Leuchter has also produced three other reports on the gas chamber question. Not to be missed is German research chemist Germar Rudolph's Lectures on the Holocaust, Controversial Issues Cross-Examined, Theses and Dissertations Press. Along with the same author's impressive periodical series, more than 30 issues to date, that he has brought out under the title Wörterjahrschrift für freie Geschichtsforschung. Not to mention his English language magazine, The Revisionist, and a fair number of other publications. All told, the work done thus far by Germar Rudolph, now aged 42 and imprisoned in Germany, amounts to a formidable scientific landmark. Finally, let us cite Canadian barrister Barbara Kulaska's opus magnum, Did 6 Million Really Die? Report of the evidence in the Canadian false news trial of Ernst Zundel, 1988, published in 1992. With its compact print, it is equivalent to a volume of about 1,000 pages in regular book format. The text shows how, during Ernst Zundel's two long trials in Toronto in 1985 and 1988, the other side, when confronted with the revisionist argumentation, simply collapsed. A real Stalingrad for the Orthodox historians, beginning with the biggest of them all, Raoul Hilberg. Essential studies have been written by the Germans Wilhelm Staglich and Udo Valendi, the Italian Carlo Mottigno, the Spaniard Henrik Einat Eknes, the Swiss Jürgen Graf, and 10 or so other authors. The 97 issues of the Journal of Historical Review, 1980 to 2002, in good part due to the American Mark Weber, constitute a mine of information on all aspects of revisionist research. In France, Pierre Guillem, Serge Thion, Henri Roch, Pierre Marias, Vincent Renoir, Jean Plantin have picked up where Maurice Bardèche and Paul Racinière left off. There are now countless revisionist-oriented publications and websites throughout the world, and this despite the prevailing censorship and repression. Nonetheless, the Holocaust remains the lone official religion of the entire West, a murderous religion, if ever there was one, and one that continues to fool millions of good souls in the crudest ways. The displays of heaps of eyeglasses, hair, shoes, or valises are presented as relics of the ghast, faked or deceptively exploited photographs, texts of innocuous papers altered or purposely misinterpreted, endless proliferation of monuments, ceremonies, shows, the drumming of the Shoah into our heads as early as primary school, organised excursions to the holy sites of alleged Jewish martyrdom, and great show trials with their calls for lynch law. President Ahmadinejad has used the right word. The alleged Holocaust of the Jews is a myth, that is, a belief maintained by credulity or ignorance. In France, it is perfectly lawful to proclaim unbelief in God, but it is forbidden to say that one does not believe in the Holocaust, or simply that one has doubts about it. This prohibition of any kind of disputing became formal and official with the law of July 13, 1990. The said law was published in the Journal Officiel de la République Française on the next day, that is the 14th of July, day of commemoration of the Republic and of freedom. It states that the punishment may run to as much as a year's imprisonment and a fine of up to 45,000 euros. But there may also be orders to pay damages and the considerable costs of judicial publication. Relevant case law specifies that all this applies even if such disputing is presented in veiled or dubitative form or by way of insinuation. Thus, France has but one official myth, that of the Holocaust, and knows but one form of blasphemy, that which offends the Holocaust. On July 11th, 2006, I personally was once more summoned to appear before a Paris court on the grounds of that special law. The presiding judge, Nicolas Bonnal, had recently attended a training course on the means of cracking down on revisionism over the internet, a course organised by the European Office of the Simon Wiesenthal Centre in Paris under the auspices of the Conseil Représentatif des Institutions Juives de France, the CRIF, the Representative Council of Jewish Institutions of France. In a release triumphantly headed, "The CRIF plays an active part in the training of European judges," this Jewish body, whose political force is exorbitant, was not afraid of announcing urbi et orbi that it listed Nicolas Bonnal amongst its pupils or trainees. And that is not all. At my trial, for good measure, the state prosecutrix happened to be a Jewess by the name of Anne de Fontette. In the closing words of her talk, requesting conviction and sentencing, she, although supposedly speaking in the name of a secular state, called for the vengeance of Yahweh, protector of his chosen people, against the lying lips of Faurisson, guilty of having granted a telephone interview of revisionist character to an Iranian radio and television station, Sahar 1. The Germans of the Third Reich wanted to extirpate the Jews from Europe, but not to exterminate them. They sought a definitive or final territorial solution of the Jewish question, and not a final solution in the sense of any physical suppression. To want a final solution of unemployment is not to desire the death of the unemployed. The Germans had concentration camps, but not extermination camps, an expression forged by Allied propaganda. They used disinfection gas chambers, operating notably with an insecticide called Zyklon B, the active ingredient of which was hydrogen cyanide, but never had any homicidal gas chambers or homicidal gas vans. They used crematory ovens to incinerate corpses and not to throw living beings into them. After the war, the photographs purportedly exposing Nazi atrocities showed us camp inmates who were either sick, dying or dead, but not killed. What with the Allies' blockade and their area bombing of Germany, and the apocalypse experienced by the latter towards the end of a nearly six-year-long conflict, famine and epidemics, notably of typhus, had ravaged the country, and in particular the camps in the western regions, overwhelmed by the arrivals en masse of detainees evacuated from the camps in the east, and thus severely lacking in food, medicine, and the Zyklon B needed for protection against typhus. In the butchery that is a war, people suffer. In a modern war, the belligerent nation's civilians at times suffer as much, if not more, than their soldiers. During the conflict that from 1933 to 1945 pitted them against the Germans, the European Jews thus had occasion to suffer, but infinitely less so than they dare to assert with such a nerve. Certainly the Germans treated them as a hostile or dangerous minority, there were reasons for that, and against these people the Third Reich authorities were led to take, due to the war, more and more coercive police or military security measures. In certain cases, those measures amounted to placement in internment camps, or indeed to deportation to concentration or forced labour camps. Sometimes Jews were even executed for sabotage, spying, terrorism, and especially for guerrilla activities in favour of the Allies, mainly on the Russian front, but not for the simple reason that they were Jewish. Neither did Hitler order or permit the killing of a person because of his or her race or religion. As for the figure of 6 million Jewish deaths, it is a pure invention that has never been substantiated, despite the efforts in that regard by the Yad Vashem Institute of Jerusalem. In the face of the formidable accusations thrown at a defeated Germany, the revisionists have said to the accusers, 1. Show us one single document that, in your view, proves that Hitler or any other National Socialist ordered and planned the physical extermination of the Jews. 2. Show us that weapon of mass destruction, which, as alleged, was a gas chamber. Show us a single one of them, at Auschwitz or elsewhere, and if by chance you claim that you cannot show us any because, according to you, the Germans destroyed the murder weapon, provide us at least with a technical drawing representing one of those slaughterhouses which, as you say, the Germans destroyed, and explain to us how that weapon with such a fabulous killing performance had been able to work without bringing on the death of either those who ran it or their helpers. 3. Explain to us how you have arrived at your figure of 6 million victims. However, in over 60 years, the Jewish or non-Jewish accusing historians have shown themselves to be incapable of offering a response to these requests. Thus, they have been accusing without any evidence, and that is what is called slander. But there is something yet more serious. The revisionists have set forth a series of established facts proving that the physical extermination, gas chambers and 6 million in question, cannot have existed. 1. The first of these facts is that for the entire duration of the war, millions of European Jews lived, plain for all to see, amidst the rest of the population, a good part of them being employed in factories by the Germans, who were cruelly short of manpower, and those millions of Jews were therefore not killed. Better still, the Germans stubbornly offered to hand over to the Allies, up to the last months of the conflict, as many Jews as they might want, on the express condition that they must not subsequently send them to Palestine. This proviso was made out of respect for the noble and valiant Arab people of that region, already violently beset by Jewish colonists. 2. The second fact, which is carefully hidden from us, is that excesses which might be committed against Jews could well bring on the severest sanctions. The killing of a single Jew or Jewess could get the perpetrator, although he be a German soldier, sentenced to death by court-martial and shot. In other words, the Jews, under German rule, continued to enjoy, if they observed the regulations in place, the protection of penal law, even in the face of the armed forces. 3. The third of these facts is that the alleged Nazi gas chambers of Auschwitz or elsewhere are quite simply inconceivable, for obvious physical and chemical reasons. Never, after the purported hydrogen cyanide gassing of hundreds or thousands of persons in a closed space, could others have soon entered in a veritable bath of that poison and proceeded to handle and remove so many corpses, which, steeped with cyanide gas on both outside and inside, would have become untouchable. Hydrogen cyanide adheres firmly to surfaces. It penetrates even cement and bricks, and is very difficult to remove from a room by ventilation. It penetrates the skin. It settles within the body, mixing with its fluids. In the United States, it is precisely this poison that is used still today in an execution chamber to kill a condemned prisoner. But that precise chamber is of steel and glass and is equipped with machinery which is of necessity quite complex. Calling for extraordinary precautions in its use, it is enough to see an American gas chamber designed for putting to death a lone individual to realize that the alleged Auschwitz gas chambers, which supposedly served to kill crowds of individuals day after day, can neither have existed nor functioned. But then, as people will ask, what became of all those Jews concerning whom we revisionists have concluded from our research that they were never killed? The answer is already there, right before our eyes and within everyone's grasp. A part of the Jewish population of Europe died, like tens of millions of non-Jews, due to the war and to hunger and disease, and another part plainly and simply survived the war in their millions. These latter fraudulently had themselves dubbed miraculous survivors. In 1945, the survivors and the miraculous escapees were there to be counted by the million, and they spread throughout the world to 50 or so countries, beginning with Palestine. How could an alleged decision of total physical extermination of the Jews has so engendered millions of miraculous Jewish survivors. With millions of miraculous survivors, there is no longer any miracle. It is a false miracle, a lie, or a fraud. For my part, in 1980, I summed up in a sentence of 60 French words the findings produced by revisionist research. The alleged Hitlerite gas chambers and the alleged genocide of the Jews form one and the same historical lie, which has permitted a gigantic political and financial swindle whose main beneficiaries are the State of Israel and international Zionism, and whose main victims are the German people, but not their leaders, and the Palestinian people in their entirety. Today, in 2006, that is 26 years later, I maintain that sentence in full. It had not been inspired by any political or religious sympathy or antipathy whatsoever. It had its ground in certified facts that had begun to be brought to light, on the one hand by Maurice Bardèche in 1948 and 1950 in his two books on the Nuremberg trial, and on the other hand by Paul Racinière, who also in 1950 published his Le mensonge d'Ulysses, Ulysses' lie. See also The Holocaust Story and the Lies of Ulysses. From 1951 onwards, year after year, our adversaries, so rich, so mighty, so bent on practicing all possible forms of repression against historical revisionism, have found themselves progressively forced to admit that we are right on the technical, scientific, and historical levels. The victories achieved by Second World War revisionism are many and significant, but as must sadly be recognised, they still remain, in our day, almost wholly unknown to the greater public. The mighty have done everything to conceal these victories from the world. That is understandable. Their domination and sharing of the world between them are in a way grounded in the religion of the alleged Holocaust of the Jews. Calling the Holocaust into question, publicly disclosing the extraordinary imposture of it all, pulling the masks off the politicians, journalists, historians, academics, and people of the churches, clans, and coteries who for more than 60 years have been preaching falsehoods, whilst all the time casting anathema on the unbelievers, amounts to a perilous adventure. But as will be seen here, despite the repression, time seems in the end to be on the revisionists' side. I shall recall here just 20 of these victories. Number 1. In 1951, the Jew Leon Polyakov, who had been part of the French delegation at the Nuremberg trial, stated his conclusion that we had at our disposal an overabundance of documents for all points of the history of the Third Reich, with the exception of one point alone, the campaign to exterminate the Jews. For this, he wrote, no document remains, perhaps none has ever existed. There is here an extraordinary concession to the revisionist case. In effect, such a formidable criminal undertaking, supposedly conceived, ordered, organised, and perpetrated by the Germans, would have necessitated an order, a plan, instructions, and a budget. Such an undertaking, carried out over several years on a whole continent, and generating the death of millions of victims, would have left a flood of documentary evidence. Consequently, if we are told that there perhaps has never existed any such documentary evidence, it is because the crime in question was not perpetrated. In the complete absence of documents, the historian has no longer anything to do but keep quiet. L. Polyakov made this concession in 1951, that is 55 years ago. However, it must be noted that from 1951 to 2006, his successors have equally failed to find the least documentary evidence. Occasionally, here and there, we have witnessed attempts at making us believe in such or such discovery, but each time, as will be seen below, the discoverers and their publicists have had to drop their claim. Number 2. In 1960, Martin Brossat, a member of the Institute of Contemporary History in Munich, wrote, neither at Dachau, nor at Bergen-Belsen, nor at Buchenwald were any Jews or other detainees gassed. This sudden and unexplained concession is significant. At the Nuremberg trial, the only homicidal gas chamber that the accusation ventured to show in a film had been that of Dachau. And the testimonies telling of alleged homicidal gassings in the three above-mentioned camps had been numerous. M. Broschat thus implicitly acknowledged that these testimonies were false. He did not tell us in what respect they were false, nor did he tell us in what respect other such testimonies relating, for example, to Auschwitz, Majdanek, Treblinka, Sobibor or Belzec should, for their part, go on being deemed reliable. In the 1980s at Dachau, a sign indicated in five languages that the gas chamber disguised as showers, visited by the tourists, was never used as such. The revisionists had then asked in what respect the room could be termed a homicidal gas chamber, whereupon the Dachau Museum authorities took down the sign and replaced it with another, on which in German and English can now be read, gas chamber. This was the centre of potential mass murder. The room was disguised as showers and equipped with fake shower spouts to mislead the victims and prevent them from refusing to enter the room. During a period of 20 minutes, up to 150 people at a time could be suffocated to death through prussic acid poison gas, Zyklon B. One will note the words potential and could, the choice of which attests to a fine bit of trickery. The information spawns in visitors' minds the idea that the said gas chamber was effectively used for killing, but at the same time, it enables the museum to retort to revisionists, "We haven't expressly said that this gas chamber was used for killing, we've merely said that it could be, or could have been, at the time used to kill a certain number of people." To conclude, in 1960, M. Broschat, without any explanation, decreed in a simple letter that no one had been gassed at Dachau. Thenceforth, the Dachau Museum authorities, quite embarrassed, have tried, by means of assorted deceitful ploys varying over time, to fool their visitors into believing that, in this room, that looks like showers, and for good reason, since that is what it was, people had well and truly been gassed. Number 3. In 1968, the Jewish historian Olga Wurmser-Migo, in her thesis on Le Système Concentrationnaire Nazi, 1933-1945, gave an ample exposition of what she called the problem of the gas chambers. She voiced her scepticism as to the worth of some well-known witnesses' accounts, attesting to the existence of gas chambers in camps such as Mauthausen and Ravensbrück. On Auschwitz I, she was categorical. That camp, where still today tourists visit an alleged gas chamber, was in reality, quote, without any gas chamber. To bring their horrible charges of homicidal gassings against the defeated, the accusers have relied solely on testimonies, and those testimonies have not been verified. Let us take note of the particular case of Auschwitz I. It was thus 38 years ago that a Jewish historian had the courage to write that this camp was without any gas chamber. However, still today in 2006, crowds of tourists there visit an enclosed space that the authorities dare to present fallaciously as a gas chamber. Here we see a practice of outright deceit. And we will leave that there for now. Watch out for more Albion narrations in the future, where this letter to President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad will be continued.